Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, the latest edition of WISO Curious, where listeners ask the question and we try to answer it. Today, the great Oregon-Oregon debate. Also, Community Voices producer Renee Wild shares a close encounter of another kind, and we'll hear from commentator Bob Brekka later in the program. Up first, the Veterans Administration is at the center of a growing scandal encompassing more than 26 VA hospitals across the country, including here in Ohio, that have been found to have excessively long waiting lists for health care. Several states are accused of doctoring those waiting lists to make it look like vets were getting care faster than they were, and some families of vets are saying the situation has resulted in the deaths of their loved ones. A recent investigation by the Dayton Daily News and Cox Media detailed the situation here in Ohio. Today, we speak with Josh Swigert, the reporter at large behind that investigation. Swigert begins by telling us how the investigation was conducted.
Last year, we did a story about the cost of malpractice claims going back 10 years in cooperation with our other affiliates at WSB-TV in Atlanta and other Cox TV stations across the country. At the time, we became aware of a more detailed database of malpractice claims that were paid, and so we asked for it at the time. Specifically, we were curious then to look at dental clinic issues here at the Dayton VA. A couple years ago, we had a problem where a dentist was found not to be practicing proper hygiene between patients, and there was allegations that veterans had acquired hepatitis. But also, this sort of firestorm came about of concerns about delayed treatment and delayed care. And since we had this information, we had just gotten, coincidentally, around the same time, we looked at how often phrasing delayed treatment showed up, and that was the former our story last week.
As far as the Dayton VA hospital, what did your investigation turn up? How serious is the situation here? And does it come close to what appears to have taken place in, say, Arizona, where waiting lists were doctored to make it look like vets were getting care faster than they actually were?
That does not appear in the database. The Dayton VA officials say that they've done an internal analysis that have found there's nothing that could possibly appear to be a secret list. Instances and how often there were deaths at the Dayton VA was nowhere near what appeared at a lot of the others. Over the last, since back to 2001, there were 16 malpractice claims that involved the death of a patient. That was the highest in any single veteran facility in the state. How they track claims is one issue. How often claims are paid is a separate one. There was a GAO report back in 2012 that was released where they looked at wait times at VA centers across the country, and that study actually did include the Dayton VA as one of their test samples. And they found that all of the VAs they looked at, there were four of them across the country at the time, and Dayton was one of them, had an issue with schedules not being done properly. Some of the VAs, now they didn't say specifically Dayton, but they said some of the VAs they looked at were using sort of mechanisms to make it look like their wait times are better than they were, but they didn't link which facility that was to the ones they looked at.
And you say around 100 payments go out every year to resolve claims that veterans died due to mishaps by VA medical centers. That's a national statistic, correct?
Correct, yeah. And the database we looked at, there were 16 deaths related to the Dayton VA. The payouts ranged in size up to $300,000. There's also several pending claims. There's a man who claims his wife died of cervical cancer because it was not diagnosed and treated quickly enough. There was a case where a veteran apparently died after his heart monitor became unattached, and that wasn't noticed at the time. There was a death after a hip accident was not properly, it was allegedly not properly diagnosed. There's a number of various really heart-wrenching details into what caused and what led to each of the claims, but there were 16 altogether, totaling about $2 million, dating back through 2001, just related to the Dayton VA.
How have Ohio politicians weighed in on the situation?
Everyone, I think, agrees that treatment to veterans should be a priority. So far, Senator Brown and Speaker Boehner have both said that they are not ready for Eric Shinseki, the Secretary of the VA, to step down, that they want to see if he can fix the problems on his own. Those are two individuals who don't often agree on a lot. So that shows that there's still some support in the big scheme of things for Secretary Shinseki. We also spoke to Brad Winstrup, the congressman from Cincinnati, who is a physician and sits on the House Veterans Committee. They are requesting a subpoena of VA data from Phoenix and across the country for the House Veterans Committee. And he sent out a release today, actually, bashing the VA for not responding quickly enough to their subpoena request. But yeah, 26 hospitals are under investigation. Speaker Boehner said yesterday, I believe, that he's becoming closer to asking for Shinseki's resignation. And no one knows exactly where this is going to go. So the question, I guess, is there something new that's going to turn up? And if there are old, simmering issues, what can they do or what are they going to do to fix those?
Josh Weigert with the Dayton Daily News, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
On Wednesday, Ohio agreed to stop using solitary confinement to punish youth in its prisons. The U.S. Department of Justice and private plaintiffs had sued the state over what they said were violations of the juvenile's constitutional rights. From Ohio Public Radio member station WCPN, Joanna Richards filed this report.
Prisons use isolation in two ways, as punishment and as a safety measure immediately after violent incidents. By September 1st, punishments will be limited to 4 hours and eventually phased out entirely. Seclusion for safety reasons will be shorter and closely monitored. The Justice Department sought relief for kids with mental illness, but the changes apply to all kids in prison. The plan also calls for more mental health care, since illness often plays a role in landing kids in solitary. Seclusion often worsens their condition.
He ended up becoming suicidal. He started digging in his arms. At one point, he was banging his head.
Melissa Booker's 17-year-old son, Kenny, spent almost 2,000 hours alone in his cell during a 6-month sentence in 2013. That adds up to 83 days. His longest single stretch was 19 days. Like a lot of incarcerated kids, he was punished for getting into fights. Kenny was diagnosed with a slew of emotional disorders before he ended up behind bars: post-traumatic stress, bipolar disorder, depression, anxiety. His mom says her son's time in solitary made him much worse. Mike knows what that's like. He asked that we not use his last name. In January, he got out of Ohio's correction system at age 20 after serving about 5 years.
The longest time I spent in solitary confinement was 18 weeks. It felt like I was a caged animal.
Mike's room in solitary had a toilet, sink, shower, and bed, and a tall sliver of a window about 2 inches wide. His only contact with other kids was when they walked by his cell, usually making fun of him because of the prison gown he had to wear. Guards checked to make sure he was alive, but wouldn't talk to him. He had no books, no pencils, and he only left his cell once a month for a 10-minute psychiatrist's appointment. Mike grew up in 37 different foster homes. He says his feelings of neglect and rejection intensified in solitary. It felt like reliving all that old trauma.
These children are going to come back into our lives.
Eve Hill is with the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division.
And so we really need to make sure that incarceration of young people is used to rehabilitate them, not just to warehouse and forget them, and certainly not to damage them in ways that make them less and less able to participate in our communities in a positive way.
The Children's Law Center, a Kentucky-based advocacy group, has been pushing Ohio for years to improve conditions in youth prisons. The director there says things have gotten much better, but mental health care was still poor, and isolation was actually increasing. In 2013, lawyers found kids in 4 facilities spent more than 60,000 hours in solitary confinement. Meanwhile, the Justice Department had started looking into mental health and seclusion in prisons around the country. In March, it filed legal action with the advocacy group. The state relented.
We don't believe that seclusion has been effective, and that's why we want to make this change.
Kim Parcell-Jump is with the Ohio Department of Youth Services. She says the prisons will adjust their strategy to manage inmates' behavior problems and violence, with more focus on prevention.
We're able to focus on our primary mission of rehabilitating youth.
But the settlement doesn't call for any additional resources. Parcell-Jump says the department can make the changes with better staff training. Booker, whose mentally ill son spent so much time alone, says she's glad for the settlement.
Hopefully no other family will ever have to go through, you know, what I went through.
But Booker's still angry over the damage her son has suffered. She says she can't wait to get him home so he can get the care he needs. For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Joanna Richards in Cleveland.
There's plenty of data on Ohio elections, but it's often not organized beyond contest, candidate, and year. But State House correspondent Karen Kassler reports now there is a website that's taken 150 years of Ohio election results to make that data more understandable, more useful, and to some, even more fascinating than it already is.
The Secretary of State and the 88 county boards of elections track election results, as do big media outlets. But there was no single resource that reporters, academics, political junkies, and history nerds could access to track trends and see what voters did, where, and when.
There was no place that combined them all so that you could look at races over a period of time and see what was happening in the different media markets, the different regions, and even in the different counties.
Mike Dawson is a longtime Republican strategist and consultant and was a top aide to both Governor George Voinovich and U.S. Senator Mike DeWine. He's also been gathering and organizing Ohio election data for years and has repackaged it all for his website, OhioElectionResults.com. While the data goes back to the 1850s, the site features detailed lists, maps, and graphs of results from races for president, governor, and U.S. senator in Ohio starting in the 1960s. And presenting the numbers and percentages in new ways reveals some surprising information. For instance, there have been 14 elections for governor since 1958, when the governor's term was stretched from 2 years to 4 years. And Dawson says those races for governor usually are not close. 10 were decided by more than 10%, and 5 races were 20-point blowouts.
That's one of the things about putting the statistics side by side. You see things that you wouldn't see if you think about them on an individual basis. You start to see trends like that.
Graphs on the website also show how dramatic the drop-off is in voter turnout in presidential and non-presidential years. And Dawson says that has benefited GOP candidates.
In the last 10 presidential races, Republicans in Ohio, Republicans have won 5 times, Democrats have won 5 times. In the last 10 governor's races, Republicans have won 7, Democrats have only won 3, which means that more Republicans are coming out in those gubernatorial years.
A couple of other interesting facts from OhioElectionResults.com. The number of voters in the 2004 presidential race jumped by 1 million over the previous presidential contest just 4 years before. But only about 500,000 more votes were cast in the 2010 governor's race than were a half a century earlier in 1958. Southeast Ohio switches back and forth in presidential contests more than any other region of Ohio. And no candidate for governor has ever won all 88 Ohio counties, although 2 U.S. senators did, Dawson's former boss, George Voinovich, and Democrat John Glenn. Karen Kassler at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
Coming up next on WISO Weekend, Lewis Wallace with Under Construction.
I'm Lewis Wallace, bringing you Under Construction, WISO's series on growth in the greater Dayton area. Ohio's unemployment rate for April came out last week, and it's about as low as it's been since 2008. I asked University of Dayton economist Richard Stock about what the latest state and local numbers might mean. He calls himself a typically grim economist, but he says even though Dayton's workforce is still shrinking, even he can admit the area's seen some good news lately.
The good news is we actually did get employment growth over this last year, albeit very, very modest. You know, in April of last year, we were at 377,200 people employed. Now, this April, we're at 378,300 people employed.
In Dayton.
Yeah, for the Dayton metropolitan area. It's 4 counties, Montgomery, Greene, Miami, and Preble. So we've gained 1,000 jobs over this last year, and that's, you know, better than losing work. I think that is primarily tied to that we've stopped losing for the most part in that federal government sector, and that's what had been killing us the year before was all the stuff associated with sequestration and everything else.
And how does Dayton's modest growth compare to Columbus and Cincinnati?
I'm not a person who, you know, is governed by envy. So at one level, I'd simply say, well, thank goodness for Cincinnati, because essentially Cincinnati, which has slightly over 1 million people, 1 million jobs, gained over 17,000 jobs April to April. And so that definitely helps Dayton, and there's certainly, as we know, lots of people, you know, taking that trip down I-75, right? And so from our perspective, it's a darn good thing that employment growth is going better in Cincinnati than anywhere else in Ohio.
What do you think accounts for those differences between the cities? What is Cincinnati seeing that Dayton's not?
Well, I think that it's primarily that's just a difference in industrial mix. There are all these people that will want to take, you know, credit for various aspects of those differential job groups, and primarily all that simply nonsense. The particular industries that are associated with Cincinnati have simply done better than those that we have had. I mean, our reliance on the base in this last year, in other years that would have been good for us in this last year, you know, that was a problem for us. One of the most remarkable things is that Cincinnati continues to have some healthy growth with respect to construction and with respect to manufacturing. And that certainly helps bolster their growth in other sectors.
And then looking statewide, Ohio seems to be coming out of this flat period where unemployment was just ticking up, ticking down, and we've seen more significant changes in the unemployment rate the last few months. What do you think explains that shift?
I think that simply means that the sequestration stuff is over. Unfortunately, that does not, you know, it's only good in contrast to what we were sitting there before. When you only gain 43,000 jobs over the course of a year, that's only worth crowing about when in the year before you were essentially losing jobs.
And then when you look at Great Lakes or Midwestern region states from the recession to now, in terms of unemployment rates, the arc looks pretty similar in a lot of the states. I've noticed some differentiation more recently, again, Michigan and Illinois struggling more mm-hmm. than Indiana and Ohio. Can you talk about those differences regionally?
I don't think, really, from my point of view, most of those primarily really would be, you know, specific industrial structure elements that account for those differentials, as opposed to particular policy measures that particular states are or are not taking. Those kinds of things really are linked to which sectors, you know, happen to, you know, have some growth at a particular point in time.
That's Richard Stock, the director of the Business Research Group at the University of Dayton. I'm Lewis Wallace. Under Construction is WISO's series on growth in the greater Dayton area.
Some say Dayton's Oregon Historic District has a controversial aspect to it, the sound of the word. Unlike the state of Oregon, the end of which is pronounced like begin, the proper noun here, used by Daytonians, is pronounced Oregon, with an ending that rhymes with John. Dayton resident Jesse Clark asked, why so curious, why?
Why is it called the Oregon District?
I meet Jesse Clark on a cobblestoned block of 5th Street in the Oregon District. He says he's been trying to answer the Oregon question for some time.
I have like books from the 50s, 40s to talk about the history of Dayton. I've Googled it a few times, asked like my grandpa and stuff like that. From what I've been able to gather, it's always been called this.
We step into Blind Bob's Tavern to ask a few people where they stand on the Oregon versus Oregon question.
It's Oregon District.
It's Oregon District.
It's Oregon District.
That's Jordan Holderman, Randy Brown, and Amy Browning. But they're wrong, at least if you ask pretty much anyone from Oregon.
But people from Oregon call it Oregon.
This is Felicia Molitore. She's from the state of Oregon, but now lives in Dayton. She wrote in to WISO to tell us that our announcers have been saying the word wrong.
Additional support comes from Oregon Printing Communications.
Felicia even sent us a YouTube link.
Oregon. Oregon. Oregon.
Okay, now, why are you an expert on this?
Because I was born and raised there.
In Oregon.
Oregon.
Okay.
Yes. Good job.
Do you have any ideas why that might be mispronounced?
No, I have no idea why. I think maybe people don't know how to read it correctly or something, or maybe it just got messed up somewhere along the way and people just don't know better.
I understand there is Dayton, Oregon.
Yes.
And is it pronounced Dayton?
Dayton, Oregon District.
But is there even a connection between the state of Oregon and the Oregon District? Yes and no, says Professor Thomas Love. He teaches anthropology at Linfield College in Oregon. Love co-authored a paper detailing the complicated history of the word.
Oregon comes from Oregon, W-A-U-R-E-G-A-N. Which was a New England Algonquin Indian word, which meant beautiful river. It was their name for the Ohio River, though nobody knows quite how the word was pronounced originally.
Love thinks Oregon is mostly an East Coast pronunciation of the name, but it's not clear which came first, the name of the state of Oregon or the name of the Dayton neighborhood. The Oregon Territory out west was established in the 1840s. According to the Dayton History Archives website, the area we call Oregon District appears in early newspapers in the exact same time period. It started with a fire truck, says Mike Martin.
In the mid-1800s, there was a fire station here in the Oregon District at the head of Brown Street on Fifth Street, and they had a pumper in there, and it was called the Oregon Pumper.
Martin heads the Oregon District Business Association. He says that early fire station is the best clue to how the district got its name.
And so it just kind of, it's stuck, and people have kind of referred to it since then.
Why it's pronounced Oregon didn't make it into the archives. So to try and get a final answer on the Oregon versus Oregon problem, I reached out to Professor Alan Metcalf, the Executive Secretary of the American Dialect Society. He says both ways of saying the name are correct because locals get to decide on local pronunciation. They own the word.
I think it's an unwritten rule, certainly of English, because if you meet somebody and you see how their name is spelled, you ask them, how do you pronounce that? And if you don't pronounce it the way the person who possesses that name pronounces it, you are wrong and that person is right. So the residents of Oregon can say that it's Oregon, and the residents of Oregon can say it's Oregon, and they can both be right because they're the ones who make the decision for it.
And Daytonians have decided it's the Oregon District. For a lifelong Dayton resident like Jesse Clark, it's a matter of hometown pride.
I've met a lot of people over the years, people who've moved here, and a lot of times people have asked me, you know, what's up with the Oregon District? And I'm like, first off, it is the Oregon District. And secondly, it's just like a cool historical part of Dayton. It's a real fun, cool place to go to.
In other words, they say Oregon, we say Oregon, because that's just how it's pronounced here. In Dayton, or Dayton, I'm Jerry Kenny for WYSO. Why So Curious is our growing, changing series driven by your questions and curiosities about the Miami Valley. Is there something you've always wondered about the Miami Valley's history, people, culture, economy, politics, or environment? Send in a question now and check back to see which questions we're considering. Why So Curious is a partner of WBEZ's Curious City, which was founded by Jennifer Brandel and is one of 10 local lore productions brought to life by AIR. It's common for people to hear things that go bump in the night. But have you ever heard country and Western music coming from an inanimate object? Community Voices producer Renee Wild shares her close encounter of another kind, along with an interesting way to use a potato.
Okay, true story. One night I was trying to fall asleep. The window was open, and I began to hear the faint strains of country music. The sound was low and muffled, just on the verge of being loud enough to understand. And then another night I heard a low voice, talking. I went to the window to figure out where these sounds were coming from and stuck my body out into the night as far as it would go and heard nothing. Just the normal night sounds of the little marsh behind our house. But when I leaned back into the room, the sound was there again. One night, I swear, I went to that window like 30 times. So this went on and off for a few weeks before I realized that those sounds, they weren't coming from outside of the house. Uh-uh. They were coming from the box fan in the window. I wanted to run downstairs, grab my husband, and make him listen to the fan. But then there was that little chance that the voices were actually in my head. So after many sleepless nights laying in bed, listening to the voices, I worked up a theory. I figured the fan was transmitting a signal from a local radio station, and the reason that it didn't happen every night, or even every week, was that there needed to be a significant amount of moisture in the air in order to conduct the radio waves. Still, I continued to keep the talking fan to myself. And then one day, I'm listening to Car Talk on the radio. The caller was telling a story about how his dad had lost the antenna off of his car during a long trip, and a mechanic told him to stick a potato on the broken stub. The car guys weren't surprised.
Don't ask me how it works or why it works, except for the fact that the potato somehow conducts electricity, and is, 'cause what your antenna is picking up is the electromagnetic radiation that comes out of the antenna of the radio station.
Immediately, I'm thinking this is what's happening with my box fan. Armed with this new scientific potato evidence, I finally get brave enough to tell someone about my talking fan. I go to my better half, and I lay the whole story out. When I get through with the potato antenna, he looks over at me and says,
I heard it too.
But were you shocked when you did realize it was coming from the fan? Because I was a little bit shocked. For a while, I tried to convince myself that it wasn't coming from the fan, even though it was really obvious that it was coming from the fan.
I was concerned.
About?
My well-being.
Really? Because I was concerned about my sanity. That's why I never told you.
No, that's, I was kidding. I do remember that I wanted to make you feel as if you were crazy. I thought it was funny. But the truth was that I heard it too.
So that's our story, and we stuck to it. Until one day at work, I relate this all to my coworker, Steve. And before I can even ramp up to the great potato antenna theory, Steve's typing into his iPhone. He turns it around to face me, and he says two words. Auditory hallucination. But I'm not buying the auditory hallucination theory, Steve. My husband hears it too. So we can't both be having the exact same hallucination, can we? For WYSO's Community Voices, I'm Renee Wild.
Renee Wild is a graduate of WYSO's Community Voices training program. For more Community Voices stories, visit our website at WYSO.org. This is WYSO Weekend. There's been a buzz in the media over the past couple of years about impending U.S. energy independence. University of Dayton professor Bob Brekka has some thoughts on how likely that scenario is.
Many of us have seen or heard news stories predicting that the U.S. will become the world's leading oil producer within a decade, and that North America as a whole could become a net exporter of oil in 20 years. Energy independence, a goal of U.S. administration since the energy crises of the 1970s, maybe within reach. So why aren't gasoline prices dropping when we fill up our tanks in the middle of this oil boom? There are several points to be made about these projections. First, we have to realize that the days of easy oil are gone. The International Energy Agency, or IEA, says that world production of conventional crude oil is on a plateau and will soon decline. New supplies of liquid fuels come from unconventional resources like shale oil and tar sands. Although substitution of new types of fuel for increasingly scarce conventional oil is exactly what economic theory would predict, prices will remain high for gasoline. Increasing production of oil in the U.S. will not lead to significant reductions in costs of oil, except in the case of another worldwide recession. Internationally, OPEC is expected to be an increasingly dominant force in world oil markets over the next few decades. Headlines that project the U.S. to be the world's largest producer by 2015 or 2020 sound good, but the same reports show Saudi Arabia retaking the lead by 2025. Perhaps the most important factor for increasing independence is improved energy efficiency. By using less liquid fuel, and temporarily increased production, the U.S. will reduce imports of oil by 2035. Although population and the economy are set to grow, and production may increase to levels close to those of the 1970s, the U.S. demand for liquid fuels will decrease. We can make great strides toward using more energy-efficient vehicles in the future with new policies such as the higher mileage standards produced by the Obama administration, something that's long overdue since Europe, Japan, and China all have higher mileage standards than we do. In the end, the biggest untapped resource in the U.S. is not deep underground and stuck in shale, but right in front of us, and accessible by learning how to live comfortably while using less energy. For WYSO, I'm Bob Brekka.
Bob Brekka is a professor of physics and renewable and clean energy. He is the coordinator of the Sustainability, Energy, and the Environment program at the University of Dayton. That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Coming up next, the Book Nook.